Welcome to the video podcast, Richard Gage 9/11 Unleashed, where truth and unity matter. Take the deep dive with highly influential voices in and around the 9/11 truth movement.
Welcome back to Richard Gage 9/11 Unleashed. Wow, do we have a guest today? Somebody who's been through the ringer, 27 years as a CIA analyst, and now a whistleblower. Yes, you know who he is. He's Ray McGovern. I'm going to introduce him in a moment. First, I want to let you know how busy we've been. It's insane because earlier in the month, we went to San Diego to speak to a trading group, DCG, about 9/11. And last weekend, I was in San Antonio with Gail. We spoke about 9/11 and COVID parallels. Yeah, right down the list. What they did and had to do in 9/11 to get away with it, they're doing right now with COVID. This is the incredible work of Kevin Ryan, who has a 37-minute video. Just find it on his website, Dig Within. He did an amazing job paralleling, just seeing how these planned events and their false solutions, which are always larger than the problem that was originally attempted to be solved. It's amazing. So I've been invited now to speak at the Red Pill Expo in Indianapolis, Indiana on July 8 and 9, I believe it is. It's definitely Saturday and Sunday in July. So we'll be going there. We'll be hosting another booth like we had last weekend in San Antonio. It was the 4th International Conference of Advanced Medicine. And our booth was swarmed with people. Wanting to know more about 9/11 because they recognize that 9/11 is not about the past. It's about the future. And if we don't solve the problem of 9/11 and wake people up, we're going to have a future that's not even worth living. It could get that bad. And it's already started, as you know, if you look around at what they have put upon us right now. So, but this weekend, guess where we're going? Boston. Because we've been asked to host a booth at the National Fire Prevention Association convention. And we're going to be with firefighter Eric Lawyer and author Raul Angulo, who wrote the book on how to fight fires in high-rises. How they do that, by the way, is to set up their command base in the first floor of high rises that are on fire. Why? Because they've never come down due to fire before, not a steel frame fire protected high rise. They don't have a concern about that. That's what they did at the World Trade Center, Twin Towers, before it came down. So, now, as a result of Building 7 falling free fall straight down into its own footprint in under 7 seconds, suddenly, without warning, well, the warnings that they put out were staged. How is it going to be in other high-rises that are on fires, that have fires in them, when they go and set up in the command base? Well, they're doing it today. They have not changed their policies. So the effort of this booth, the evidence booth that we have there, will be to alert the fire protection community that we have a discrepancy, a disparity between the policy, current policy of the firefighters, and the current possibility that a skyscraper, according to NIST, can come down at free fall acceleration right on top of them, due to a few small scattered fires. So we'll report on that, and San Antonio also coming up. And you can join us in Indianapolis, by the way, the Red Pill Expo, Google Red Pill Expo. And we need help at the booth. We typically get swarmed and sell everything we've got in the way of DVDs and books and so forth. So need lots of help. Well, without further ado, I would like to introduce my wonderful guest today, Ray McGovern. 9/11 to Ukraine, a world in peril. Ray McGovern has supported the 9/11 truth movement for years. Well, all the years I think I've been in it, which is 15 for me. And we'll discuss why. He will. He will then provide an analysis of the post 9/11 geopolitics, including leading up to the war in Iraq, for which he actively sought to expose the lies of the Bush administration, the subsequent wars in the Middle East, and the Ukrainian revolution and current war. We'll discuss that too, as well as increasing tensions now with China. Ray came to Washington from his native Bronx in the early 60s as an Army infantry and intelligence officer. He then served as CIA analyst for 27 years. We're going to find out what happens in the CIA today. We got the insider. From the administration of John F. Kennedy to that of George H.W. Bush, Ray's duties included chairing the National Intelligence Estimates and preparing the president's daily brief, which he briefed one-on-one to President Ronald Reagan, his five most senior national security advisors, for 4 years, from 1981 to 1985. In January 2003, Ray co-created the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, VIPS, to expose how intelligence was being falsified to justify war on Iraq. On the afternoon of the day, February 5th, 2003, Secretary of State Colin Powell misled the UN Security Council on Iraq. And Ray's going to talk about that too. His organization, VIPS, sent a blunt memorandum to President George W. Bush in which they gave Powell a C-. And we're going to hear more about that. On July 20th, 2002, CIA Director George Tenet had told his British counterpart that the intelligence and facts were being fixed around the policy of regime change in Iraq. Ray had something to say about that too. On the early afternoon of May 4th, 2006 in Atlanta, Ray confronted Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld on live TV with pointed questions like, "Why did you lie?" I'd call that a pointed question. "To get us into war that was not necessary and that has caused these kinds of casualties." Well, you're going to hear about the response to that question and the fact that he turned his back on Hillary Clinton during her presentation about freedom of speech in Iran. I want to hear about that too. Ray's opinion pieces have appeared in many leading newspapers and other publications in the U.S. and abroad, except for the New York Times and the Washington Post. They seem to not like him. Don't worry, Ray. They don't like me either. His website writings are usually posted first on consortiumnews.com, as well as here on Ray, here being there, on raymcgovern.com. Many are then cross-posted everywhere. He has debated 3 times at the Oxford Forum. He's appeared on the NewsHour, C-SPAN, Washington Journal, CNN, BBC, a number of domestic, I guess they like him at CNN. Let's find out how they let Ray McGovern in at CNN. It's been a while. We're going to find out. A number of domestic Russian TV channels, Al Jazeera, RT, Press TV, CCTV, and many other TV and radio programs and documentaries. Ray's BA and MA degrees from Fordham University are in Russian history. So we're going to ask Ray, how is it that Russia invaded Ukraine? He understands the history there. We're going to talk about it. The language, literature he knows about with minors in theology and philosophy and classics he has. He's taught Russian as an adjunct at the University of Virginia. Ray is fluent in Russian, German, and Spanish. He and his wife have been married 55 years. No fair. I've been married 6 years, but I got a long way to go. I'm going to catch up with you, Ray. They have 5 children and 9 grandchildren. Without further ado, Ray McGovern, welcome to Richard Gage 9/11 Unleashed. It's my honor to have you here, sir.
Thanks, Richard. That bio I really should update. It's 60 years now.
Oh, my gosh. I'll never catch up with you now.
Very patient wife living with me, and we have 10 grandchildren. So I think in the business now of creating grandchildren, but 10 is good. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, you bet. And we've been at the same conferences for over 15 years. I want to hear your perspective and how it's grown and changed. But first, over those 15 years since 9/11, well, 20 years now, I came on late, Ray. I was 5 years late. I was rooting for Colin Powell as you were criticizing him. I was hoping that we go into Afghanistan and Iraq and get those bastards who did this to us. I mean, I was a Reagan Republican. I was really angry at Al-Qaeda. And boy, did I have a turnaround come 2006. But let's take you back to 9/11. And how did you find out? When did you start questioning what really happened at 9/11?
Well, in short, Richard, the truth has never come out, as you well know. The cover stories were shot full of holes by anybody with any common sense. And I suppose the glaringest indignity was when Governor Kaine and Lee Hamilton thought they'd write a book after they had explored and examined what happened in 9/11. And they started out by saying, you should know that we, the 9/11 Commission, which we chaired, was set up to fail. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of grumbling in Washington about whether we could ever do our job. We would be not bipartisan, but just the opposite, at each other's throats, and that we never could come up with convincing explanations. That turned out to be the case. But these two naive fellas, you know, I mean, naive, well, that's the wrong word. They've both been around for a while. No, Kaine had not been around for a while. When he was asked how he was going to do this job, I remember distinctly, he said, well, you know, I'll come down from New Jersey once a week, and I'll try to read some stuff, and you know, go back to my office there, the college. And I said to myself, whoa, this guy's going to be easy to be deceived by this. So when we're talking about this, it's not only the things I mentioned that they fessed up to, but they also fessed up to the fact that they were not given enough access to classified information. Mm-hmm. They weren't given enough money. They weren't given enough time. They said that in their little book less than 2 years after the commission report was published. I mean, hello.
Didn't they say they were set up to fail as well?
That's exactly what they said. So, you know, you don't have to be a professional skeptic or still less a conspiracy theorist to read their book and to say they were apparently set up to fail. Yeah, they said in writing the book, we were set up to fail. So let's get on with it here. What I really appreciate is people who still strive to find out the truth. And that, of course, is you all and other people in the movement. The truth has become a very rare commodity in Washington, rarer still in the 15 years that you've been following all this, Richard. And we, as you mentioned, set up something called the Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity when we saw that the truth that we used to present to the president was being modified, was being cooked, was being shaped to the recipe of what the policy they wanted to do, Cheney and Bush. So you can't have sanity without some truth. And especially you can't have sanity if you know that the truth is somewhere, but you don't have it. And the reason you don't have it is because it's deliberately being covered up. I can talk a little bit about the CIA and its responsibilities, but I'll keep that short.
I was talking to Ray earlier on the show, and I said, you know, we don't know how the CIA works. We don't know what an analyst does. I mean, this is our one opportunity to get an inside look into this mysterious organization that has created so much evil around the world, I'll say.
Well, Richard, when John Kennedy made his famous plea for us not to ask what the country could do for us, but what we could do for our country. Mm-hmm. I was a senior in college. I was majoring in Russian. Long story short, I was commissioned at graduation, but they put off my call to active duty for a year. I got my master's degree in Russian studies. Did my 2 years in the U.S. Army as an Army infantry and intelligence officer. And then naturally kind of went over to the CIA to be an analyst there. Now, we were told, and the reason I thought it would be great is we were told we have access to just about everything, all the information available. Ironically enough, 80% of the information available on Russia was in open sources.
too many inside secret.
Yeah, we didn't have any satellites, and we didn't have much of a capability of intercepting communications. So, you know, it was sort of like a glorified professor who didn't have to give speeches and didn't have to correct exams. It was great. And we reasoned to what was going on in the Soviet Union and in Soviet foreign policy, which was my shtick, using the overt sources and the media analysis techniques that we had developed since Stalin, for God's sake. So it was heady work. My account initially was Russia-China, the Sino-Soviet dispute. I mention that now because when you live long enough, as I have, you see immense change, and you need to be open to the fact that things change. Now, our task in the 60s was to prove to the troglodytes who thought once a communist, always a communist, you can't say that the communists would be fighting with one another. Come on, you're being taken in by propaganda. The Russians and the Chinese are just like this, not like this, like you say. It was really hard to persuade people otherwise until we started getting these U2s and other collection devices, which picked out 15, count them, 15 Soviet divisions on the Chinese border.
Oh, my God.
Then there were 40. Now, as we reported this to our masters, Henry Kissinger comes to mind. He stroked his chin and said, if I were a Chinese, I think I'd be a little afraid of the Russians. What do they intend? There had already been some shooting matches across the Amur and the Ussuri River. China had claimed vast swaths of Siberia, really taken by unequal treaties in the 16th and 17th centuries, mind you. So there was a real thing. So anyhow, Kissinger said, you know, I think we can exploit the fears of China as to what the Russians are going to do and play them off against the Russians. Long story short, that enabled, it was 50 years ago now, That enabled progress on Berlin, progress on strategic arms limitations. Why? Because the Russians were afraid that the Chinese would steal a march in developing very close relations with the United States to their detriment. So it was sort of a race, and Kissinger was a really smart guy, right? It was sort of a race. Who could prevent the other from stealing a march, as I say? So long story short, the first arms control, significant arms control treaties were concluded in this atmosphere. I had the privilege of having a couple of my people in my branch, Soviet Foreign Policy Branch, as part of the SALT strategic arms limitation talks, delegations in Helsinki and Vienna. And I was in Moscow in May of 1972 when the first and when the most meaningful treaty was signed. It was called the SALT Treaty. And it talked about ABMs, anti-ballistic missile treaty, okay? And in short, it was the cornerstone for strategic stability from 1972 to 2002. Mm-hmm. Count 30 years when George Bush said, I don't think we want to be in that treaty. What did it do? It limited the number of ABM, anti-ballistic missile sites, that each side could have. First, it was one. Then it was two, and then they limited it to one. Did it work? Yeah, it did work. Did the Russians cheat? Yes, they did. Did we catch them? Yeah. Did they tear down what they had built? Yes, they did. That's the way we used to do things. We would call them, and when they were too embarrassed by the very sophisticated photos we showed them, they tore them down. Anyhow, that was then. Now, the bottom line here is that today the Russians and the Chinese have an alliance that they describe themselves as exceeding a normal alliance of the Cold War, an alliance which has no end. And that's the big tectonic shift that brought, because China and Russia both feel very, very threatened by what the U.S. considers enemy number one, China, enemy number two, Russia. I mean, doesn't make a lot of sense to take on two countries of that size, but our geniuses from the Ivy Leagues have done that, and we'll have to see how it works out. I get ahead of myself. Let me just finish with the CIA business by saying that there are two CIAs that people need to know about. One was the one that President Truman set up after World War II. See, he wanted one central place, therefore Central Intelligence Agency, where he wouldn't have to distill what the Army, the Navy, the new Air Force at the time, what other people at the State Department were telling him. He'd have one unit responsible solely to him, right? Mm. For career advancement, for everything else. And he expected us, as he said, to give him untreated, his word, untreated intelligence. In other words, he knew that the Pentagon would say that the Russians were always 12 feet tall. He knew the State Department would always be defending the policies that they were conducting. And so he came to us and said, tell me like it is. You have career protection for doing that. Now, did that work?
It did, yeah.
That promise was kept, at least in the Soviet sphere. We were able to tell it like it is up until the time when Bill Casey came in under Ronald Reagan. And then it became a little itsy-kitsy because he enlisted a fellow named Bobby Gates, who incidentally worked for me in the 70s and became the head of the CIA later and then the head of the Defense Department. And they thought that the Russians would never, never, ever give up the communist system. Of course, they were dead wrong. But there were enough honest people in the agency to make sure that the policymakers at the very top, the ones that I briefed, were given the straight scoop on Gorbachev, Shevardnadze, and the people really trying to change the Soviet Union, and succeeded in doing so in a bloodless way. Mm-hmm. So you have the analysis. Then you have the operations, just a word on the operations. After the war, when I say the war, World War II, there were some really, really courageous, really daring, bold people came back. They were part of the Office of Strategic Services, okay? They were the spies that jumped behind enemy lines in Norway and Germany and France. They overthrew a couple governments. They came back and they said, okay, thanks for the applause. Should we stay around here? Now, people as smart as George Kennan said, of course we need you. The Russians are overthrowing governments. We need to be able to do that too. And the question was, where do you put these guys and women? I mean, institute or a department for overthrowing governments, that didn't sound quite right. So Kennan and others got the idea, we're creating this analysis group that's going to be working with some spies for information. So that's going to be classified. Let's put the operatives all in with the analysts. It'll be one happy family. It wasn't. It was a structural fault from the beginning. Even though they try to keep them separate, it's really hard. So even now, it's very, very difficult to do honest intelligence because you're often working alongside somebody who's running operations that, if you're honest, you would say, this operation is for the birds. Mm-hmm. I'll just end up by saying our ethos from the analysis group was always to tell it like it is. And when we saw our former colleagues, for God's sake, I mean, people we worked with, deliberately falsifying intelligence, giving it to the Secretary of State, Colin Powell at the time, to justify an a war of aggression is what it was against Iraq. I mean, that was beyond the people. And so we formed a little group 2 months before the invasion of Iraq, and have been publishing ever since, most recently on the 1st of May, where we warned the president about the danger of nuclear war if, as some of the people in his administration insist, you put Putin's back against the wall and you weaken the Russian government and army to the point where, well, they do. I think first they'll call on their patron China, and if that doesn't work so well, they have nuclear weapons for the first time in decades. They're actually referring to them. And, God forbid, but this is something that Biden needs to recognize. We wrote to him and we were very gratified a week later to find out the head of National Intelligence told the Senate Armed Services Committee the same thing, namely, Putin regards the Ukraine battle as an existential threat. And if he goes down to defeat, which is the declared administration aim right now, that's not going to be a good thing necessarily. That's going to make him desperate and could actually lead to the use of small nuclear weapons. And he ought to be aware of that, Mr. Biden should. And we were gratified, as I say, that apparently they probably came to it by themselves, but we were a week to 10 days. We did on the 1st of May. Avril Haines, the director of National Intelligence, testified to the Senate on the 10th of May. Very rarely do we have that kind of temporal sequence where we warn first and then she warns the Senate. So we keep active and we follow these issues, Ukraine especially right now. And I'm happy to talk about anything else you'd like to talk about, Richard.
Well, yes. I mean, the Ukraine war really didn't start when Putin announced his operation, right? I mean, this goes back in history. Can you just alert us to some of the things we might have missed that we didn't see on CNN, i.e. The coup of 2014 and perhaps even before that? But let me, with that, having said that question, I just want to reassure our viewers that Gail is able, though she's not on screen, to take some questions and get them to me by text today. So we've worked it out. So go ahead and leave your questions on YouTube, and she's going to filter them in when we get ready for that. But the history of the Ukraine war, what's really going on here, Ray?
Well, this goes back to the fall of the Berlin Wall and the falling apart of the Soviet Union just a year or two later. This was a catastrophe for the Russians in terms of the ones that were left in what they called their near abroad, Ukraine and other Belarusian, other places where tens of thousands of Russian citizens were pretty much left to fend for themselves. That's why Putin refers to it as a catastrophe. He has disavowed Stalin. He has disavowed all the communist practices that used to go on. And this may come as a surprise to some, but he's not out to take over the world like the communists were. He's not even out to take over Europe. What he's out to do is defend Russia from the encroachment that has come after Russia fell apart. Now, let me explain. Mm-hmm. Okay, the Berlin Wall falls November 1989. George H.W. Bush, to his credit, calls up Mikhail Gorbachev, and he says, Mikhail, you know, I just want to say I'm really sorry for all your troubles there, but I want to reassure you, I'm not going to dance on the Berlin Wall. We're not going to take advantage of it. Okay. But I do want to get together with you. I mean, Central Europe is falling apart. We need to, how soon can you meet me? 3 weeks? Okay. Let's meet in Malta. 1st of December, the two meet in Malta. George Bush says, look, you know, I just wanted to tell you person to person that we don't want to exploit this. We want to create some peace there. And this is going to take some negotiation, and it's got to be quick. How soon can you see my Secretary of State? And Gorbachev says, well, 6 weeks. Okay, good. James Baker is the man. He's going to arrive in Moscow 1st week of February. He does. Okay. Now, James Baker was a darn good Secretary of State. He was also a lawyer, a slick lawyer from Texas. Okay. So he says to Gorbachev and to Shevardnadze, the foreign minister, he says, look, what we'd really like to have now that things are all falling apart, we'd like to have a reunited Germany. Now, Richard, I have to tell you that when I heard that was being bandied about, I'm old enough to, I didn't want a reunited Germany. Maybe I watched too many war films as a young boy. Yeah. But the whole purpose of NATO was to keep the U.S. in, Russia out, and Germany divided, Germany down, as it was said. So now, McGovern lived through World War II very young. But, you know, he was a part of a country that lost 26 million people to the Nazis. That's what Russia lost, 26 million Soviet citizens. We, by comparison, lost 420,000 soldiers, okay? So that's big. So put yourself in Gorbachev's place, right? And Shevardnadze say, all right, reunited Germany. Yeah, right. No, we're serious. Oh, okay. Well, what's the pro? That's quite a quid you want us to swallow. What's the pro? Well, Baker says, well, how would this be? We will promise not to move NATO 1 inch to the east from the East German border, from the border of a reunited Germany, not 1 inch to the east. And Gorbachev and Shevardnadze go back to their offices, come back the next day and say, well, now, wait a second. If we understand correctly, you're not going to move NATO 1 inch to the east toward Russia. And for that, we will accept a reunited Germany in NATO, but no nuclear weapons in it. And Baker says, that's exactly it. Now, Baker's a lawyer. Gorbachev and Shevardnadze, not lawyers. Under the pressure of the moment, they simply said, promise? I mean, cross your heart, hope to die? Oh, God. A Baker, a lawyer, should have known a damn thing has to be. I mean, I have my father's a lawyer. He said, Ray, get it in writing. Fuck God, get it in writing. They didn't do that. Okay.
There's no treaty. There's no contract.
Well, there are copious notes. And my Jack Matlock, the U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union and to Russia. I mean, he was there. He was there in Malta. He was there when James Baker said, well, how would it be if we made a promise? So he's telling me chapter and verse. And besides that, all kinds of official notes by our own people and by Helmut Kohl, who was the Chancellor of Germany at the time, they all had it right down what the promise was. I had a chance, a little anecdote, to raise this with one of Gorbachev's advisors at the time, a professor named Kuvaldin, really, really sharp guy. I said, I was in Moscow about 7 years ago, and I said, tell me, why wasn't that written down? And he gave me the school solution first. He said, well, number one, Warsaw Pact still existed at the time. Number two, we hadn't really checked it out completely with Germany yet. And we need, you know. But he said, the number three and most important, Mr. McGovern, is we trusted you. Okay. Well, long story short, George H.W. Bush loses the election. Bill Clinton comes in, and for domestic political reasons, namely to get votes in the Middle East, where there are a whole lot of Poles and Czechs and Slovaks and Hungarians and so forth, he decides to enlarge NATO, guess what, many, many miles to the east. When that promise was made, there were 15 nations in NATO. Now there are 30. If my arithmetic is correct, I think that pretty much doubles the number, and they all happen to be more than 1 inch to the east. So that started it, okay? Now, Putin, when he took over in 2001, he said, why are you doing this? I mean, we're on our backs here. I mean, we were devastated by all this. With the help of some of your Wall Street guys, you may not know this, not many people know this, but when it all fell apart and this fellow Yeltsin came in, he was very pliable. You give him a couple of bottles of scotch, good scotch, okay? And he was very, very, I mean, I do not exaggerate, okay? And so oligarchs from Wall Street, with the help of the Harvard boys advising, and oligarchs from Russia took over and pretty much decimated the wealth of Russia. A little specific here. According to World Bank statistics, between 1991 and 1994, the mortality rate for Russian males went down from 63 to 57. 4 years, people were starving. People were committing suicide. It was really bad, and Putin watched all that, okay? And then this indignity where, oops, all of a sudden, they're enlarging NATO. So he says to the West, why are you doing this? And he doesn't really get any answer. Now, if you fast forward to 2008 now, this was a crucial year. People started talking about, oh, well, we've got all these other people in NATO. Let's get Ukraine and let's get Georgia in NATO. And you know, one of the things that WikiLeaks has done for us is provided raw information like cables, messages from the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. And through that revelation, we have the cable in which our ambassador in Moscow, Bill Burns, reports back that Sergei Lavrov, who new foreign minister at the time, he's a pretty old guy now, but he's still foreign minister. Lavrov calls me in and he says, Mr. Burns, do you know what Nyet means? But yeah, I mean, well, niet means niet. Niet means no Ukraine in NATO. This is a red line for us. If you do this, we will have to decide whether to invade. We will have to contend with a civil war for sure. Niet means niet. Tell your people. And Burns is a pretty straight arrow. He reports back to Cheney, really. He's running things, but Condoleezza Rice is the Secretary of State. I dare say, to put this in context, says Bill Burns, the Russians have their own spheres of influence. They have their own anxiety about people hard up on their border in a military alliance. So they're concerned. So why do I mention that? Because most ambassadors wouldn't cut across the grain like that. Bill Burns did. So there's no doubt as to what was being warned here. First of February 2008, on the 3rd of April 2008, NATO at a summit meeting in Bucharest says in their official declaration, I think it's paragraph 23, Ukraine and Georgia will become members of NATO, period, end quote. Whoa. So we kind of go like this to Putin and his folks. And nothing really happens until 2014. So we're talking about 6 years later, when a coup is mounted on the Maidan, center of Kiev. A coup is mounted by whom? Well, it was actually by friends I used to work with and people in other friendly intelligence services. How do I know that? Well, I know that because the Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs said that to our ambassador in Kiev on an open line. Now, I mean, her name was Nuland. She says to Jeffrey Pyatt, the ambassador, look, we're going to do this little coup here. We have Yats is the guy. He's going to be the prime minister. Keep those Nazis in the background for a while. And then Pyatt says, well, the EU won't like this. She says, F. I won't say it on your program. She uses the F word. She's F the EU. Okay. And then he says, well, what else? She said, well, we have just word from this fellow, Jake Sullivan, who works for Joe Biden, vice president. And he says that you need a international personage to tie this together and make it stick. Joe Biden is ready. He's willing to come in at the end and give his imprimatur to this. Now, did I make that up? No. That's in a open telephone conversation intercepted at the very end of January 2014. Now, how do I know about that? Somebody gave it to YouTube. Was that put
Thank
on YouTube?
God for YouTube sometimes.
Yeah. On the 4th of February. But I said the coup was at the 22nd of February. That's right, folks. When I heard that conversation, I said, oh, poor Yatsenyuk. These other guys, well, poor Nuland and poor... Look at the language she used. Yeah, there's not going to be no coup now. It's blown.
No, right.
That's so. Now, 18.
Now, wait, why wouldn't the EU go for this new government, which would be pro-West, presumably, and pro-EU? Why wouldn't the EU have gone for this coup?
Well, the EU had this nicety about coups in Europe. The EU is a little bit accustomed to what U.S. policymakers often encourage in terms of coups. And it just cut a little too close to the grain to think that we would do an active coup there. Mm-hmm. And so there was this concern on the part of Pyatt, the ambassador, and Nuland. And curiously enough, as I say, she said, F the EU. Now, she apologized 2 days later for saying that. Joe didn't really mean that. But, you know, if you needed further substantiation for the credibility or authenticity of this conversation earlier, or else she's apologizing for it. Anyhow, it went forward, and we put in place, that is, Yatsenyuk became the prime minister, the same guy that was blown on the 4th of February. Here it is, the 22nd, 23rd, he becomes the prime minister. First thing he says, we're going to join NATO.
Oh, my God. He said that. Huh?
Yeah. And we're going to make Russians speak Ukrainian. We will not recognize Russian as a national language, official language. So there was a big upheaval in Crimea. 90% of the people there are Russian stock. People in Lugansk and Donetsk out there in the Donbass, they didn't like it either. They didn't want to be put under this coup government. And so they rebelled. And that was the beginning of the troubles here. Now, one should recognize that the Crimea is especially important to Russia because it is the place where they have their only all year round ice-free naval base. It's in Sevastopol. They lost hundreds of thousands of people fighting to regain that base during World War II. Catherine the Great, about the time of our revolution, was the one that brought the Russian rule down there. It has always been part of Russia, but most important, it's always been part of their naval capability. So here, by the way, Putin was in Sochi at the Winter Olympics when the coup took place. He came right back the next day and he convened this little, his advisors said, what are we going to do? We can't let Sevastopol, our only ice-free naval base, go with the NATO, for God's sake. That's in the cards if we don't do something. So somebody said, well, you know, didn't Crimea used to be part of Russia? They didn't know their history because, of course, it was part of Russia. And when Stalin was removed in 1953, there came into power a fellow named Khrushchev, okay? Now, Khrushchev was pretty much a Ukrainian. He was born in Russia, but right on the border there. He had a lot of Ukrainian powerful political friends. And he thought, well, you know, if we gave Crimea to the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic, I may get a little strengthened here. I'm not a Stalin. I need to consolidate my strength. And so he took out a piece of paper. You know what a ukaz is, right? So in an ukaz, he just said, okay, from now on, Crimea is part of the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic. Now, did that matter? Not a whit. The Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic was joined at the hip with the Russian Soviet Socialist Republic. And so it was just one of 15 republics. When did it start to matter? When Russia fell apart. Ukraine became independent, and all of a sudden you have Russia's main naval base in a separate country, okay? So there was a deal worked out. I think it was a 50-year lease worked out with the Ukrainians. The Russians would pay the Ukrainians to lease that territory. And there was the permission to put, I think it was 30,000 troops there to guard the base. And that all was done. It was always very, very amicable at the time. But then after the coup, that became at risk. Long story short, they decided that instead of just doing the ukaz, like Khrushchev, they would ask the people in Crimea what they wanted. They didn't want to be under the coup regime. That was clear. Did they want to be annexed? Well, they had a plebiscite, and the plebiscite said very distinctly, yeah, we want to be annexed by Russia. And that's what happened the following month in August. And Putin said two things at the time. He said, you know, in a sort of a jocular way, I wouldn't want Sevastopol naval base to be such that we Russians would have to ask NATO for approval to visit their base. I'm sure that the NATO guys are just wonderful fellas, but I'd rather have it just the way it is now, where they have to ask our permission to visit our naval base in Sevastopol. And they need something not chocular, okay? And I want to leave this incredibly important point here. He said, you know, the reason that we really wanted to annex Crimea, and of course they wanted to, was partly because of their aspirations to make that part of NATO, but even more important was their plan to put strategic missiles in Ukraine. These would be a no-no. These would endanger not only the Russian ICBM fleet there in Russia, but Moscow, St. Petersburg itself. So,
but did they really have a plan to put strategic missiles in Ukraine, or were they? Was this just a rumor?
Thanks for the question. Yes. What has happened now is that there are two major missile sites, one completed in Romania and one almost completed in Poland. Now, they are described as ABM, anti-ballistic missile sites again, okay? But when the Russians asked us why you need ABM sites right there, the answer was not North Korea, Iran, because Iran is a threat to Western Europe. So we're trying to protect Western Europe.
They're pointed in the other direction.
But then Iran signed up to this agreement where they would have, even if they had a nuclear missile, which they don't, even if they had that kind of a nuclear warhead, they couldn't possibly use it under this agreement. And so Putin came to the U.S. again and said, well, now wait a second. it can't be against Iran. You've got them pretty much shackled. And they said, no. Could be. You know, 10 years from now, Iran might try to get a nuclear missile and a nuclear hit. So, you know, Putin looked at them and said, look, we know, and I have this on tape. We talked to these Western correspondents, and he said, look, we know what the Pentagon's plans are. We know that these ABM sites can easily be changed to fire what Putin calls Tomahawk missiles. There's no H in Russian, right? So they're Tomahawk missiles, or even more dangerous, hypersonic missiles from these sites. You don't need to do much. All you need to do is get these missiles in, and then overnight you put one of these little CDs or you put a little disc in the computer, and that changes them to a very dangerous offensive capability. Putin has said very clearly, we know what the Pentagon's plans are. We know that these missiles fit completely well, right, in these missile sites. And so these aren't really ABMs. They're offensive strike missiles. Mm-hmm. Now, why is that important? Well, I mentioned already that when Crimea was annexed by Russia, Putin was saying, you know, we can't allow offensive strike missiles in Ukraine or in Crimea. One thing that most people have not been told, because it's been suppressed. Late last year, in December of 2021, Biden and Putin on the telephone, 7th of December, agreed to start negotiations on a new European security framework. The Russians were really hard on this, and they wanted to do it right away. And to his credit, Biden said, okay, we'll meet in January 12th. How's that? All right, we'll meet. And then all of a sudden the Russians said, we have to speak to Biden. Putin wants to talk to Biden before the end of the year. They talked by telephone on the 30th of December. Now, interestingly enough, the U.S. readout of that conversation is very sparse, doesn't say anything. The Russian readout says, and I quote, Mr. Joseph Biden said that the U.S. has no intention of installing offensive strike missiles in Ukraine, period, end quote. Whoa. Major concession. You go back to, you know, what I said before. Now, what happened? I don't know. Was that a... The only thing I can discern is that it's likely that when Joe Biden woke up the next morning, his advisor said, Joe, come on, you can't do that. Those are our crown jewels. We can hold those in abeyance. And so one way or another, Russians were told, look, remember what Biden said to Putin? Forget about it. Now, this is inference. I don't have a piece of paper that says that, but I have the Russian readout. I have the fact that nobody disputed what the Russian readout said, and I have the disappearance of this all-important concession by Biden into thin air. So I think it's a reasonable conclusion. Why am I saying all this? Well, if I were Putin, I will have learned yet another lesson of how, you know, when a president promises something, even if it's one-on-one, even if it's directly on the telephone, don't count on it, okay? Because his subordinates, sometimes the military, sometimes his wet behind the ears sophomore foreign policy advisors, sort of say, well, forget about it. He didn't really mean that, okay? So what does that mean? Well, that means trust is gone.
Yeah.
And if I read things correctly, when the following month, the negotiators were not allowed to talk about this anymore, there was no word of it. And then when the Ukrainians started massing against the pro-Russian provinces there, Donetsk and Luhansk, in February mostly, Putin was saying, well, you know, I've pursued this thing for a long time. We've made these proposals. It doesn't look like they're taking us seriously still. Ukraine is an existential threat. If they go back on their word, if they put offensive strike missiles in Ukraine, we are really in some danger. Now, let me explain to the layperson what that means. It means that whereas in the old days with ICBMs flying in, across continents, you had about 30, 35 minutes of warning from launch to target, okay? So let's say they detected this thing and they thought it was the real threat, and that's 5 seconds. And so you could get to your commander-in-chief and say, you know, what should we do? Should we destroy the rest of the world right away, or should we wait? Now, if you put these offensive strike missiles right up hard on the Ukrainian border, as they are in Romania, and as they're going into Poland, well, that gives Putin about 8 minutes, 9 minutes to decide if it's a Tomahawk, if it's a Tomahawk cruise missile. If it's a hypersonic missile, he's got 5 to 7 minutes. This is important. I mean, put yourself in his place. Would you want to be faced with no time, virtually no time, to make this decision as to whether to destroy the rest of the world? Well, I don't think so. And so,
wasn't this the position that JFK was in when the Soviet Union went to Cuba and put missiles in there?
That's exactly right. You know, and I'm really glad you mentioned that, because that is the analogy. Mm-hmm. We regarded Khrushchev's attempt to put offensive missiles in Cuba as an existential threat. We raised the prospect of nuclear war to get those things out of there. Luckily, JFK was advised by some pretty sober-minded people who countermanded the military, who wanted to nuke not only Russia, but China as well. That was the war plan, right? And they worked out a sensible solution where there was a quid pro quo. We agreed silently or below the surface to remove missiles from Turkey. So something was worked out then. The important thing is we felt an existential threat, and we were willing to risk nuclear war. Now, a little vignette here, which is relevant. I mentioned I was commissioned in ROTC and that I was put off for active duty for a year. On the 3rd of November, 1962, I reported as a young second lieutenant in infantry intelligence to Fort Benning in Georgia. And we were all really bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. We wanted to learn these weapons like the new grenade launcher, new weapon. Guess what? There were no weapons there. None. No howitzers. Nothing. And so we said to the sergeant, what's going on here? This is the Army Infantry Intelligence School. Where are the weapons? And he looked at it. He said, they're all down in Key West. They're all down right opposite Cuba. And they've been there for 6 weeks. Whoa. Talking the 3rd of November. Okay. That's how close we were. And that would have unleashed. Now, one thing to remember here is that although we are very proud, we intelligence folks flying U-2s, we found the missiles in Cuba, right? When JFK asked us, well, are they armed? Do they have nuclear tips on them? We said, well, we assess that they don't have nuclear tips on them. Now, I wasn't there at the time, but I would imagine JFK should have said, if he didn't, what the hell does we assess mean? What's your evidence? We assess that. I don't care what you assess. Are they armed or are they not? And if you don't know, tell me. Now, guess what? We didn't know for 30 years they were armed.
Oh, so they were armed.
They were armed, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Many people know that. But McNamara himself and others learned from the Cuban leaders and from the Russians they were armed. So those were the stakes, okay? Now, Richard, I'm really glad that you brought this up because that's the analogy here. In other words, Kennedy feels an existential threat. Why don't we put ourselves in Putin's position and give him some understanding as to how he might feel that Ukraine is an existential threat? You've got NATO doubled in the number of nations. Now you want a country that not only has a lot of animus toward Russians, many of them, but is right hard up against Russia's border. That's a bridge too far. And I think Putin decided, well, this is probably the best time because the Ukrainian forces, most people understand, were arrayed against the eastern provinces there of the Donbas. Putin claims they were ready to go in and clean out the Russian-speaking people, many of whom, hundreds of thousands of whom, are Russian citizens. And he thought that, you know, this is probably the time. Now, the big thing here, and the thing that I think is equally important, all these considerations, is China. China, yeah. Well, China, right. Because China has been threatened by NATO 2.5 years ago. China was warned NATO's going to regard China as the principal threat, just as the U.S. does. NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty, China, well, they said it, okay? China knows it's in line for this kind of treatment. Okay, so long story short, the Russians and the Chinese got together, and as I read it, well, I know that Putin went up to Beijing on the 4th of February of this year to launch the Olympics, China, Beijing Olympics. And they had a very strong statement of solidarity at the time. And this I don't know for sure, but I think this is the way the conversation went. Putin, best friend Xi. Xi has called Putin his best friend. Okay, Putin. Colleague, comrade Xi, I don't know how to say this exactly, but the West has not taken me seriously. They're not taking our concerns seriously. We drafted those treaties. They've sort of thumbed their nose at it. I even had a commitment one-on-one from Biden not to put offensive strike missiles in Ukraine. And all of a sudden, that was forget about it. Okay. I think we may have to go into Ukraine, the more so since they seem to be arrayed in such a way as the bulk of the Iranian forces are right opposite Donbass. They may be going in to clean out the Russian speakers there. Z. You mean after the Olympics are over, right? Now, I don't know that, but, you know, one day after the Olympics are over, Putin recognized Donetsk and Lugansk as independent countries. And 3 days later, boom, he invades Ukraine. I don't like people invading other countries. Neither do the Chinese, for God's sake. It was their fundamental bedrock principle, non-interference in the affairs of other countries. Right. And yet, in my view, they gave Xi a waiver. They said, okay, well, we're next. If you fail, you go ahead and clean them out. Now, I don't think Putin, calculating as he is, would have dared do this on his own had he not been assured that at least there was tacit nihilafstat or imprimatur, or whatever you want to call it, that Xi was willing to support him even if he did this. Otherwise, we're dealing with really reckless kind of Putin, not the kind of person that I think he continues to be. So that's a mouthful right there, but it really kind of, well, you mentioned that I don't get on CNN. I haven't been on CNN for about 12 or 13 years. They won't let me say these kinds of things because yeah. I would say that my military advisors, from veteran intelligence professionals for sanity and other close friends, tell me that Russia is bound to clean out the Donbass. They're pretty much three quarters of the way there. The question is, when can we stop the bloodletting? When will the U.S. Stop trying to fight this thing to the last Ukrainian? What we need is a ceasefire now or tomorrow. And that's possible, and we could work this thing out. But right now, it looks like we have to take Secretary of Defense Austin's word at face value that the principal aim here is to weaken Russia. That has very little to do with Ukraine other than to use them as the kind of tools, the kind of people that we often use for this kind of purpose. You know, I'm really sorry to have to say that.
Mm. Well, you mentioned in an interview posted on your website just today that we're also putting increasing pressure on China by reaffirming our relationship with Taiwan. I'm just wondering if when Putin and Xi got together, that they had a quid pro quo. All right, you can take Ukraine, but you're going to support us when we take Taiwan. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about Taiwan and the Chinese government.
Yeah.
And then I know we have some questions for you too after that.
Yeah, good. Yeah, well, that article that I posted started out saying flummoxed. Mm-hmm. I was asked to explain. This is an interview I had yesterday, I guess. Yeah, yesterday. I was asked to explain why the United States, in its wisdom, is reversing 50 straight years of stability vis-a-vis China by questioning this one China policy. Now, 50 years ago, as I mentioned, Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon, to their credit, saw what was happening. We helped them see it, that the Russians and Chinese were at loggerheads. We thought it'd be forever. Nothing's forever. And that they could take advantage of it. Okay. And so that was what concerned us. Now, what the U.S. did in terms of quieting the Chinese was to say, look, we have such domestic political entities that are in favor of Taiwan, still many years after the war, that we can't really say that you can accommodate Taiwan. What we say is that there's one China, and it includes Taiwan. Okay, is that all right? And this ambiguity existed now for 50 years. It was cleverly constructed so that the U.S. and China could still deal with each other, the U.S. recognizing, at least in concept, that this was just one country, not two countries. But lately, Jake Sullivan and Tony Blinken take it into their head, well, yeah, let's grab the Chinese dragon by the tail, wag it a little bit, and let's get concerned about us giving military aid, National Guard cooperation with Taiwanese troops. I mean, Tammy Duckworth from Illinois, I guess, a senator from Illinois, she visited there 2 days ago. She talks with the president of Taiwan. These kinds of contacts have not happened before, and they're sort of a stick in the eye of the Chinese leadership. Now, this is not so alarming in my view. I mean, it's alarming that we would be taking on these two giants, but with respect to why we're doing it, I mean, we are no match for the Chinese forces in the area. Every war game that we've played, we lose, okay? So I think that this has simply domestic sources here. In other words, as Putin himself has said, U.S. foreign policy and military policy is really hostage to domestic political requirements. I think that Biden and the others see, well, we have to be real strong against China because people are saying we're not strong enough. And the notion that China was going to take over Taiwan by military force is what most of my Chinese specialist colleagues say, not very likely. They take the long view of this. They see it as inevitable. They're in no rush, and it would really be counterproductive for them to destroy Taiwan before taking it over. They see it as a natural process. We don't. We see everything in the terms of 2 years or 4 years. It's a political thing, and I think that's what's at work here. But the bottom line here is that we have, I think I used this yesterday in this interview, you know, when you're in grade school, right? And you're pretty strong, but they're two really big guys. You're sixth grade, and these guys are already 6'1", right? Now, if they're on the top of the hill, and you're playing King of the Hill, right? Are you being a little foolish to take the hill or challenge them? I think you are. And that basic bedrock principle seems to be disregarded by these Ivy League educated, exceptionalist people who may believe that we are the exception to the rule, that we are entitled to have dominance over Russia and China. And yet it wouldn't be so bad, Richard, if it didn't happen before, you know, 50 years ago in Vietnam. Mm. Same guys, same Ivy League types, with McGeorge Bundy, Walt Rostow. They were out of Harvard. You know, they were the best and the brightest. And they were convinced that these, what do they call them? These barefooted brown people with pajamas on. They'll never prevail. We got all these planes and all this stuff. Well, they did prevail, but these guys were never held accountable and they never learned their lesson. And some people think that because if you have the right educational credentials and the right contacts, you can run a foreign policy. Well, right now, that doesn't seem to be a very good bet.
Yeah. It's as if they're trying to create the chaos because stability is an anathema to them. They can't profit from stability. They have to create chaos, and maybe they're after a new order out of that chaos.
Well, I think you're right on that. And you mentioned the word prophet, right? Well, there's a lot of profiteering going on. And you may know this. I coined an acronym. It's called Mickey Matt. It sort of rhymes with Mickey Mouse. That's how you can remember it. It's what President Eisenhower called the MIC, the MIC, the military industrial complex.
Yeah.
Now, he experienced it at its nation, at its beginnings, and he warned about it in his farewell address. And he said, look, the accretion of power by the MIC, the military industrial complex, whether it's wished for or whether it's just inevitable since the war and the industrial might that we built up during the war, is a danger to our democracy. And the only antidote is a well-informed citizenry. Whoa. We don't have that now. We have the Mickey Man. Let me spell it out for you. Military industrial congressional intelligence media academia think tank complex. Why does the government say media as if in all caps? Well, because media is the linchpin. Without the media, you can't do this. And the media is part of the Mickey Mat. I mean, they're owned by the mega corporations that run the Mickey Mat. And so we're in a really tough place here because most Americans are oblivious to the fact that we spend 55, 60 cents out of every dollar of our tax money on armaments, many of which, the majority of which don't work, on aircraft carriers that are sitting ducks for modern strategic missiles and tactical missiles, and they're just completely unworthy. So we don't have a well-informed citizenry. And if you're thinking about, you know, this policy in the Far East, well, I'm sure the Navy wants to build more ships. The Seventh Fleet doesn't have enough ships. China has more ships than we do. And so, ineluctably, we have to build more ships. And, you know, that's really expensive, building them more, especially when they're aircraft carriers that are so obsolescent that they're sitting ducks. So, you know, there are people that profiteer from this. There are people like Raytheon and Lockheed that early this year, January, I think, sent a letter to the stockholders. Look, you know, this is going to be a really good year for business. The tension in Ukraine is getting higher and higher. We're in good shape to profit on this. They said that. And of course they are. Tomahawk missiles by Raytheon, Lockheed. So, you know, that's a factor that's always in the background, but needs to be brought to the foreground. And that's why I'm hoping that all your viewers here have taken copious notes on the Mickey Mat. Mickey Matt, MICIMATT, Mickey
Matt. Hopefully that's on your website, raymcgovern.com. If not, I'm sure it'll be there today for you. Ray, I think we have some questions for you.
Good.
Let's see what we can gather up here. The history of the CIA. What about the CIA from the beginning? What about Alan Dulles directing the CIA from the beginning? Was he running an accountable, honest organization only during the first few years?
Well, no, not even during the first few years. The first few years, of course, had a couple of directors other than Alan Dulles, but he pretty much is the father of the CIA. He was not held accountable to anyone, to presidents or to Congress. The way they worked things is they had like Senator Russell and some other senators who were briefed on some of the operations, and they said, oh, sure, well, don't tell us about it, that we want plausible denial. And Truman was able to do, not Truman, but Dulles was able to do pretty much what the hell he wanted. He even persuaded Eisenhower to approve that crazy idea of landing emigres on the Bay of Pigs to take over Cuba. That was the worst. He approved it, that is, Eisenhower did, when John Kennedy came in and he said, "Eisenhower approved this?" And they said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, all right, go ahead and try it." And of course, it was exactly the wrong way for Kennedy to begin his tenure. What'd he do? He said, "Look, you can go ahead and do this. You can do a try to land on the beaches, but don't expect any cooperation or support or backing from the active duty armed forces of the United States. We're not going to do it. We're not going to do air support. We're not going to do anything. We're not going to become overtly involved. So on those conditions, go ahead." Now, here's something. On Alan Dulles's desk after he died was a little settle, a little piece of paper, sort of coffee stained, and it revealed that I, Alan, fully expected that once push come to shove, this young president would be forced to come to our aid with air support and other means, and we could get Castro that way. Okay. So you don't need my interpretation of that. That thing is available. Now, Kennedy, what did he do? He stuck to his guns, and he didn't defend this ragtag group of folks that the CIA had put together. Alan Dulles was responsible. He had to wait, because you don't fire Alan Dulles right away. He had to wait a couple months to fire him, but then Dulles got back at him, didn't he?
I think so.
He got back at him, and the way he got back at him was he killed him. Now, you don't have to take my word for that. What you need to do is read JFK and the Unspeakable. It's a book that's been out for about 15 years now. It profits from all the prior research, and it's done by a very, very serious fellow whose name I'll remember in a half a second. And
James Douglas?
Pardon?
James Douglas?
Yeah, James Douglas. Two S's on the end of Douglas. So that, you know, I had read a lot of stuff, but this one convinced me. And of course, you're left with the situation where presidents of the United States cannot release the documents showing what happened. Example, 4 years ago, Donald Trump gets up early in the morning anyway, and he says, today, by congressional requirement, we are required to release the rest of the JFK assassination documents. And so we're going to do that. That afternoon, Donald Trump gets up and he says, "I've been talking with the CIA and the FBI, and they say we can't release those documents just yet. So come back in 6 months." So McGovern says, Trump is saying that he has to do what the FBI and CIA says. Well, that's exactly what he was saying. So McGovern writes a little note in his calendar, 6 months, right? Check it out. Zippo, nothing. Okay. So what does that tell you? I mean, hello, you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to realize what was in play. There's all kinds of, who ran the Warren Commission? Anybody know? I'll give you a hint. The first name was Allen. The last name was Dulles. How did he insinuate himself onto the Warren Commission? Well, LBJ was happy to have a cover-up.
Oh, yeah.
Most people I trust believe that whereas LBJ wasn't actively involved, he was pretty much aware of what was going on. It's that bad, folks. And, you know, my record is pretty clear. I'm a sober analyst. I usually don't go any much further than the evidence will take me. And those are my conclusions on that. So, yeah, as a CIA Is the CIA and the FBI, are those people we call a deep state powerful? They are. Are they more powerful than the president? Yes. They were more powerful than President Trump when he tried to release these documents. And it is now certifiable that the deep state, and I'm talking about the CIA, the FBI, James Comey's FBI and Andy McCabe's FBI, John Brennan's CIA, and elements of the Justice Department itself did their utmost to prevent Donald Trump from becoming president of the United States. And when he did, to make sure that he was emasculated in terms of doing anything useful, especially with respect to Russia. Now, I have been called a conspiracy theorist, but now I have proof, and it comes from the courts. Okay? Remember the Russian hacking? Remember how those Democratic National Committee emails that showed that Hillary Clinton had pretty much stolen the nomination from Bernie Sanders? That's what they showed, folks, okay? Remember how they were publicized by WikiLeaks right before the Democratic National Committee? And who was blamed? The Russians. How'd they get it? The Russians hacked. The Russians hacked. The Russians hacked. Now, for some strange reason, John McCain, act of war. The Russians have done an act of war. For some strange reason, James Comey, the head of the FBI, says, let's let this cyber firm of dubious reputation do the forensics and find out what happened in those DNC servers and computers. We'll hire CrowdStrike, run by a guy who worked for Bob Mueller, and I know real well from the FBI. Yeah, let's catch CrowdStrike. Go CrowdStrike, lets it be known really early on. Oh, Russian hack, Russian hack. And then, and then the head of CrowdStrike, his name is Sean Henry, is required to testify. The date is December 5, 2017. Under oath, Sean Henry says, there is no technical evidence that anyone hacked those DNC emails. Not the Russians, not anyone. We've looked at the forensics. There's no technical evidence that anything was hacked. Now, hacked means electronically taken, okay? Now, there was evidence, and this came up in the testimony, that some of those emails were collected sort of prior to being extracted, but no evidence that they were extracted. No technical evidence. What does that mean? my friend Bill Binney and others suggest, well, that just means that they were getting ready to, you put a thumb drive in and you extract those ones. There's no technical evidence, but you get the meat, okay? You put that in your pocket, you take that over to WikiLeaks in Europe or whatever, and it's. So what am I saying here? I'm saying that everybody believes the Russians hacked into the DNC. Everybody, 80% of Americans, okay? Hmm. Now, this guy says, no, there's no technical evidence. Not only that, but we have a trial that transpired in Washington just last week, which shows that lawyers working for Hillary Clinton, who say that Hillary Clinton approved this operation, deliberately used false data to connect the Trump campaign with the Alpha Bank in Russia. And this is before the election, right? This is October. And to say publicly, tweets and everything else said, we have a link here between the Trump campaign and a bank, and we don't know much about it, but it was all manufactured, it was all made out of whole cloth. That has come out in this trial. So the courts are the court of last resort, so to speak. We're finding out all the things that were used to render Trump incapable of repairing things with Russia. Why? Well, think about the Mickey Mat. You have no major opponent in Russia. I mean, you need an enemy. China is good, but you need two enemies. are better than one, so to speak. So I don't know how I got off on that tack, but this is really important stuff, because the bottom line here is that most Americans believe that Putin hacked into the DNC and therefore won the election for Trump. Now, I should make clear here, I can hear my wife in my ear saying, Ray, make sure you remind people what you think of Donald Trump. My political views should not matter, but just for the record, I think he was the worst president the United States ever had. Even so, that doesn't mean he was wrong about everything. And the evidence is so preponderant that they tried to not let him be president and then sabotage him at every pass. And so what we have as Americans believing that these 4 years of Donald Trump, whose fault is that? Putin. I mean, I think, you know, some Americans would think that's the worst thing you could charge anybody with, 4 years of Trump. Anyhow, that's my personal prejudice. But Putin's blamed on everything. 5 years of this stuff, you can easily believe that Putin eats babies and stuff, which is close to some of the propaganda that's coming out of Ukraine and picked up daily by CNN, BSNBC, and the others.
Hmm. Thanks, Ray. Brian asks, what is your take on the thesis from Chris Hedges that the Russians actually want this economic chaos in order to facilitate the creation of a Russo-Sino currency to supplant the U.S. dollar as the global reserve currency?
I hadn't heard that Chris has gone that far. I think the effect is going to be pretty much what he predicts. I don't think you can say that the Russians actually prepared this or orchestrated this for that result. I see things more as, you know, not happenstance, but I don't see a great big Russian plot behind this for the reasons I adduced before. Mm-hmm.
But there is, I mean, the American economy is suffering, and more so as food plants are sabotaged and inflation from previous digital dollar production is essentially killing us. It's almost as if that's being done on purpose. So there will be a flight to another more stable form of currency, right? And could that be? And that that's what you're saying, that, yeah, the Sino-Russia a combined currency based on the dollar is what we're kind of looking at, right?
Yeah. I just have to say that my opinion of the economic advisors that Putin has is no higher than my opinion of his foreign policy advisors. I don't think they can see farther than 4 years or even 2 years. My suspicion, not being an economist, is that they botched this up royally, and that over the longer term, Europe, for God's sake, what are they going to do this coming winter? Mm-hmm. There's got to be some sort of resolution here, and it's got to be before nations face uprisings. Even here, you know, we are divided as never before. There are lots of possibilities for real, real disruption of our society. And once these economic things start to bite, it will perhaps affect us less than Europe. But still, you know, paying, what, $8, $9 for a gallon of gas is going to really hurt a lot of people. And people are going to ask why this has to be. And the business about Putin being responsible for all this will wear thin after a while when people will start to feel it.
Yeah. Ray says, which aspects of the 9/11 attacks did you investigate? Did you rely on video and photos to investigate? Or did you read the official reports? What do you think was not investigated about 9/11?
Well, I read the official report. I mean, I could go on for quite a while. The official report was a cover of Pure and Simple. The role of the intelligence agencies in allowing 9/11, whether deliberately or not, has never been really investigated for the same reasons I adduced before. The deep state is in control. We know that NSA had information, very precise information, and we know that they covered it up. We know that the CIA, the Federal Aviation Administration, we know that others had information that should have raised all kinds of alarm bells, and yet nobody put them together. The thing I would like to see investigated would be Dick Cheney's role in all this. He was the one orchestrating what was going on in Washington at the time. He was, for example, General Michael Hayden's, who was head of NSA at the time, a protector. He was the one that allowed Hayden not to face the scrutiny, such as it was, that CIA and FBI faced. So there's a, my suspicion is that the information, such as it was ample. The appetite for that information was meager. And the reason for that was Dick Cheney, Pure and Simple. Why was it that Condoleezza Rice, the so-called assistant to the President for National Security Affairs, couldn't convene a meeting on Al-Qaeda until 1 week before 9/11? Why was it that Richard Clark couldn't get the straight answers from the head of the CIA, George Tenet? They had two of the hijackers under surveillance. They knew where they were, but they didn't tell Richard Clark, the counterterrorism chief. How did they think they could get away with that? The FAA, they had these teams that used to simulate attacks on airports and airplanes. One of its leaders, a really good fellow, member of VIPS, Bogdan Zakovic, led these teams, and they were able to penetrate airports and airplanes about 90% of the time. They warned their betters in the Federal Administration, Federal Aviation Administration, they would do nothing. Why? I mean, all it would take is $90 to put a line, put a lock on those cockpit doors, for God's sake. That's what the Israelis did, and they wouldn't do it. So there's lots of blame, but in terms of intentionality, was it allowed to happen deliberately? Well, I've seen enough of Dick Cheney and the other things he's done, not to believe that he's an evil man, but that he does evil things. And seeing him in charge of the Iraq thing and the Afghanistan thing and persuading this little fellow, George W. Bush, to do this and that. And that famous, when he was in the bunker and that young naval fellow came in, they said, Mr. Vice President, I forget what the minute, is it 90 miles out? No. There's still same instructions? Yes, same instructions. 5 minutes later, Mr. Vice President, 30 miles out now. Same instruction. Did I change the instruction? No, same instructions. Well, 5 minutes later, plane crashes into the Pentagon. And that was always, always intriguing to me. What was that all about? Who was that guy? We should be able to figure out who that naval adjutant was. Has anybody looked? I had a chance to, it was one of these things that happened in Washington where I was speaking at a anniversary of the Constitution Day, the day that the Constitution was signed. And so was Norm Mineta, Secretary of Transportation, under whom the FAA operated. And since he was there in the bunker with Dick Cheney, when that young man came in and asked those questions, I waited for him to read his part of the Constitution after I did. I waited for him in this very elaborate hallway at Georgetown University. And as he came out, I said, "Norm, how are you? Ray McGovern." Now, Norm Mineta didn't know Ray McGovern from anyone. But in Washington, you know, it's not a forgivable sin to forget the name of somebody who could look important. And I looked important, got out of tie on everything. So he says, "Ray?" I said, "Yeah, Ray McGovern. Let me ask you a question, Norm. Who is that guy? Who is that fellow who came in and said 30 minutes? And he looked at me, and I was like, "My God." You mean that plane up there in Pennsylvania? I said, No. You're there. You're in the bunker, the one that went into the Pentagon. I don't remember. No, the plane in Pennsylvania. We were worried about the plane. But so it was as if you were programmed never, ever to address what happened in the bunker. I mean, it was scary. He looked really startled, like, you know, he didn't expect the question. And then did he remember the right answer? Well, he knew what he was not supposed to say. I reported all that later, but nothing ever came of it. I mean, who was that naval guy? And why can't we just ask what it was that he was referring to? I don't think it was Pennsylvania. You know, what do I know? But the time frame and so forth suggested that it was the Pentagon. And so did Cheney know about what was going to hit the Pentagon? Well, I don't know, but Don Rumsfeld seemed to know because he got the hell out of his office, didn't he, wander around somewhere else before the plane hit. So there are all kinds of these anomalies. I'm sorry I don't know the answers. You guys, I applaud for looking into these questions, particularly the physical evidence, and maybe someday soon, well, I don't wish this on it, well, maybe Dick Cheney will go to his eternal reward and everybody will stop being afraid, or enough people will come forward and say, you know, this is how it went down. Mineta, you know, he's got an airport named after him now. You keep your mouth shut, that's what happened. But maybe he could be persuaded before he meets St. Peter to clean up his act and to confess as to what went on in the bunker that particular day. Who knows? All things are possible.
Yeah, we do need a break in the 9/11 truth movement. I mean, this was the most highly defended building in the world, presumably the Pentagon. And yet an hour and a half after both towers are hit, or an hour after, I think it is, you have this plane flying completely unmolested, traveling around the Pentagon, and they can't even bring it down with a surface-to-air missile or a Stinger or something.
A little footnote, Richard. I mentioned these two Al-Qaeda types out in California that the CIA had under surveillance and were watching them. They were two of the hijackers, and they were the ones, if memory serves, that were piloting or said to be piloting Flight 77, was it, that went into the Pentagon. So here you have these same two fellas that were kept away from Richard Clark, the counterterrorism guru, and also the FBI, until just 1 week before the attack. And they happened to be the ones that were in charge of the, or piloting Flight 77. I know there's a lot of dispute as to whether anyone was piloting that plane, but they were said to be the ones.
Yeah, or whether there was a plane at all. There's a lot of dispute about that too, but we won't go there today. Candida says, what are the two dominant deep state factions? And could you briefly describe their leadership in political corporate spheres? Because apparently, not only is the Republican and Democrats two different wings of the same bird, apparently, is the deep state factionated like that as well?
Well, under Trump, they all came together. And part of that was to defend their own backsides. I mean, there's lots of evidence floating around. Why? Well, I think James Comey, the head of the FBI, put it best. He wrote a book and he said, you know, and this is a quote, I was operating under the premise that Hillary Clinton was sure to be the next president of the United States, end quote. Oh, okay. So if that's your premise, and you're sure, you can take all kinds of liberties with the law secretly, as is the FBI's custom, without telling anybody like Grassley or anybody like that in Congress. You can do what you want. And so we did. What did you expect? Claps on the back, emoluments, stay in office, still head the FBI for 10 more years. You didn't expect prison. You didn't expect to be held accountable. And so they weren't even careful with their written stuff. I mean, you can retrieve a hell of a lot from a computer, as you know. So if that was the premise, they took great liberties with the law. Was there interference in the 2016 election? There sure as hell was. And that was by the FBI, by the CIA, by these fancy lawyers working for Hillary Clinton who cooperated with Steele, the Steele dossier, and did this Alpha Bank stuff. You know, the Alpha Bank thing has never been shut down. How many people that influenced to say that, you know, Trump has, we see forensic evidence that he's in touch with the Alpha Bank. You know, the irony of it all is she still lost. I mean, hello? That's mind-boggling. They didn't expect that at all. And so what next? Well, you got to band together and make sure that Trump doesn't do anything. He doesn't even get to release the JFK files, which by act of Congress are required to be released. Mm-hmm. Trump could not even release some of the assessments that the CIA did on Russiagate. The one that said Russia hacking, well, Trump had prepared that for release on his last day. The head of the CIA, a known torturer named Gina Haspel, said, no, we're not going to do that. And so it lies somewhere, if it hasn't already been destroyed, she's really good about destroying things. It lies somewhere in some vault, and never shall we see it. So, yeah, the deep state is kind of the people who see as their duty to pretty much rein in whatever they need to have reined in. And, if these people went at it as a fare-thee-well, it really, the evidence is very clear that just as with respect to 9/11, they were for the cover up an awful lot. And the irony is that, you know, even a broken clock is right. I think it's what, two times a day, right? Okay. So most, in my view, of what Trump said was not true. But when he said that there was interference in the 2016 election, that happened to be true. But everybody is so affected by the Trump syndrome that they can't possibly believe that it's true. Mm-hmm. And so even though we have forensic evidence, we have sworn testimony, even, and of course, the media keeps it out. Now, Trump was also right, in my view, about the 2020 election. I don't mean counting votes and all that kind of stuff. I don't know anything about that. But, you know, when Hunter Biden's laptop was left behind with incredibly incriminating evidence, not only with respect to the hapless Hunter, but with respect to his old man, that was covered up. I mean, it was amazing. Only Glenn Greenwald had the guts to write about that. The New York Post was knocked off Twitter. I mean, God, you know? And was the laptop genuine? Well, there was nothing to indicate that it wasn't genuine before the election. It turns out to have been genuine. And now we have even the New York Times and the Washington Post saying, oh, yeah, you know, we thought that was not genuine because 51 former senior intelligence types told us that this was typical of the way the Russians run things. It was Russian disinformation. Now, that really hurts. I mean, none of those 51 were part of our honest group, but they got people like Clapper and Brennan and people that are known to have been prevaricators for forever. They got them to sign on this little thing. Now, we don't have any concrete evidence, but this is consistent with the way the Russians do things. This is, we think, Russian disinformation. Now, all that happened in October of 2020. George Stephanopoulos has a one-on-one instead of a debate with Joe Biden. Does he ask him about this? What, are you kidding? You're kidding me? Were you born yesterday, McGovern? Of course he doesn't. And so this is kept out of the public eye for the crucial weeks leading to the election. I don't know who would have won the election if this was publicized. And, you know, I'm not saying it would be better if this was publicized. But, you know, the principle is there. This information was available. It was tangible. It was certifiable as correct and authentic. And the media made sure that not only was it discounted, but it was dismissed with the help of these deep state 51 CIA and other deep state officials as Russian propaganda. There's a good case study for you. That's the power of the deep state in collusion with the media. That's why I call it the Mickey Mat. Remember it.
Yeah, we'll be looking for that definition again on your website soon, Ray. Final question, and we have a dozen more questions, but my gosh, we just don't have time for all of them. We've been on almost 2 hours, but Anthony wants to know, does Putin or do the Russians believe the official American 9/11 narrative? Do you think they're, and why didn't Putin blow the whistle on it? I mean, if there's a real enmity between these two, the leadership of these two countries.
Well, back then, Putin was new in office. He was the first, if memory serves, to express condolences, to tell President Bush that he sympathized with what happened. The prospects for collaboration in anti-terrorism work and other work were very ripe at the time. They could have succeeded. I know some people who were involved in that effort, and they were really kind of disappointed that this opportunity did not get exploited to the degree it can. With respect to the Russian people, I hate to tell you this, but they're a bunch of conspiracy theorists.
Who are they?
They all believe that this was that the 9/11 commission thing was a crock. Oh. Cover up. Can you imagine that? I kid, of course. Russians are a little bit more circumspect. I mean, you know, they know how to read between the lines, unlike what is available here in the United States. We tend to believe what the media says. They don't.
Well, how about the Russian media?
Well, the Russian media really didn't play much with it. I mean, the catastrophe was such that the emphasis was on that. And I don't really recall that they took a line, a kind of a certain line on whether it was it deliberately allowed to happen or what. So, you know, I don't really have a good handle on that. My suspicion is they didn't take much of a concerted approach to it. They're as much at sea as most Americans.
Hmm. Well, Ray McGovern, it has been an amazing day with you. We appreciate it so much. Thank you for coming. Let's tell everybody where they can find your work. RayMcGovern.com. How easy can that be? Final thoughts for us, Ray, before we let you go, from Richard Gage and 9/11 Unleashed.
Well, Richard, I thank you for having me. I was going to say what my webmaster, my son Joseph, always talked about our website. Thanks for mentioning it. If I forget to mention it, he gets very angry.
Oh,
he says, Dad, hello. All this work, and we make it look pretty good. He says, so not only say RayMcGovern.com, but always add, if you don't get it, you don't get it. So on that note of hubris, let me say thanks again. Always good talking to you, Richard.
Likewise. Thank you so much. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. We'll see you next week. On Richard Gage 9/11 Unleashed.
Thank you for joining us on yet another informative and soul-stirring episode of Richard Gage 9/11 Unleashed. We'll be on the air again next week with another very special guest in the 9/11 Truth Movement and beyond. Visit us at richardgage911.org, where you can find our schedule, learn about the WTC evidence, and of course, sign up for our emails and support us. Don't forget to like, share, and subscribe.